newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
This is The Media Project, an opportunity for a half hour of commentary and analysis. And some days when we're on our game, insight into the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, the editor of the Times Union. Dr. Alan Shartok is here, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio.
Hi, my good friend.
Rosemary Armeo is here, investigative journalist and former UAlbany professor. What do you say?
Hello.
Well, hello to you too. How about that? Right, and Judy Patrick, Vice President of the New York Press Association, former editor of the Daily Gazette. What's going on with your life?
Nice to be here this morning, this afternoon, tonight.
This evening.
Whenever you're listening.
All
good times, absolutely. We're glad to have our listeners with us. And we have a number of listeners, actually, who have responded to previous shows, which I think is not a bad way for us to start this time because they actually might stimulate some conversation. Here's a reader. She is a reader, actually, as this shows. Jenna is commenting on the death of newspapers. She says, as a high school English teacher, I would bet a big part of the death of newspapers is a change in how people read. Most of my students struggle to sustain any kind of longer reading than tweets. Newspaper articles are longer than people want to read, in my opinion. Reading in our culture is changing due to technology.
Does that mean they're not reading books?
Well, it's not true, is it? Bookstore sales are strong, but they're not reading news. And actually, you know, in the ethics of journalism, your responsibility then is to try to package it in a way that makes it accessible to people, right?
Right, to find a new way to write in small bits and pieces. They can't sustain attention for more than two or three
graphs. Chunkification of the content is what
there,
some
there was
call.
An article years ago called "Is You Know Google Making Us All Brain Dead?" That was the idea of it. And it isn't just book sales are up, but not hard books, not difficult, right, complex or older books where the language is a little inaccessible. And they don't read anymore. They search for information. They're looking for an answer to a question.
You know, Rex,
I say it in students. Sorry, Alan.
Go right ahead.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. No, you know, Rex, how you always say journalistic ethics. And here I've always thought journalistic ethics was an oxymoron. So,
he's out of reach, too.
So, you know, I'm fascinated by the idea that one of the things you always say, Rex, is that, you know, basically like doctors or others, do no harm.
I did not say that. I have never said that. I wrote a whole column about that last week saying that that is what the...
I must have missed that one.
Yeah, you must have. It's the Hippocratic Oath says that. That is not at all ever what journalism has said.
But what
you've made that up.
Well, what do you say?
The Code of Ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists, the third tenet of it, I urge you to look it up, says minimize harm. That is consistent with our truth-telling responsibility to not intentionally harm people, to do what you can to avoid harming people. But truth-telling is the fundamental responsibility. We know that that's going to hurt people sometimes. My example in my column last week was involving the Bishop Emeritus of the Albany Catholic Diocese, Howard
Just
Hubbard.
Just what I was thinking of, yeah.
Who has been accused of misconduct in sexual relations with young people. Many people, myself included, hold Bishop Hubbard in very high regard. That doesn't mean that we downplay the story because we're afraid of harming him or hurting the feelings of his loyal flock. It means that we tell the story, but we don't trumpet it. We don't ignore his point of view on this. To minimize harm is different from doing no harm. You can let doctors have that. That's not our job. Our job is to truth tell, and sometimes that hurts.
Okay, well, let me carry this on just a little bit, because I can see that I've severely annoyed you.
Well, because you misquoted me.
Which, of course, means I am delighted. So my question here is, if a priest is accused of having relations with a teenager, and the priest says, I never did it, a career is ruined, perhaps, or not, or a bishop in Buffalo or in Albany looked the other way while priests were escaping from being responsible. My question to you would be, what if, in fact, the priest never did it, but somebody said he did it? Now, it's in the paper. There'll always be people who believe it. We know that. Is it fair?
Well, what's your alternative, Alan? Are you not going to report the allegation until you have satisfied yourself that it's okay, that it's not true?
No. I think that's unkind of you.
But I mean, what are you saying? We report stuff?
I'm not responsible for what we should do. I'm just simply saying that harm can be done, even inadvertently.
Exactly.
And that is not a nice thing.
Well, are you saying that we shouldn't report allegations of crime? When people get arrested, we should only report on that when the verdict has come in, innocent or guilty? I mean, that's a little bit of what Australia does.
That's right.
You can't report anything until everything is said and done. That does not allow the public access to the criminal justice system at all.
I would posit that harm has come from not reporting the allegations. We have gone years where women in particular, for example, refused to come forward because they knew or thought that nothing would happen. The media helped with that. Whenever we have stayed quiet about something, the problem has simmered. That refers to civil rights abuse, incest, anything, suicide, anything we don't write about does not get solved.
So, Rosemary, are you willing to say, okay, despite the fact that you're right, if we don't do it, we could be complicit in making something even worse, that people have been harmed who didn't do things?
Yes. I mean, I use the example all the time in ethics classes about Oliver Sipple. He was the man who jumped out of the crowd and stopped Sarah Jane Moore from shooting Gerald Ford. He pushed her arm out of the way. It was an act of heroism. He became, after that, the most sought-after newsmaker in the world. He saved the life of a president. Turned out he was a closeted gay man. He was living in San Francisco in order to keep his parents from finding out. His employer didn't know about it, but he did hang out in San Francisco gay joints. Harvey Milk knew him well, and Harvey Milk knew the power of this, that at that time in the mid-1980s, gay people were regarded as depraved, horrible, you know, lunatics. You don't want your children near them. It was liable to call someone gay in a newspaper. So the newspaper in San Francisco got the story. Would you print it or not? They did print it. And he sued, Oliver Sipple sued, and he lost because he was a newsmaker. News came out because he had inadvertently, but nevertheless had stepped into the public arena. He later committed suicide. It certainly hurt him. But it was the start of a whole different way of looking at gay people in the United States. The paper, the newspaper, did its role as truth teller.
And it's not like we print every willy-nilly allegation that comes before us, because certainly a lot of them come. We do vet them to some respect, and we don't print everything that we hear.
Absolutely true. We're not careless about it. That's why it's so offensive, Alan, when you say that you think that journalistic ethics is an oxymoron, because we weigh ethical decisions every single day. There are crazy allegations that come without any substantiation. But, you know, when a lawsuit is filed, a lawyer actually has a responsibility not necessarily to believe what is being said, but to not intentionally mislead the court as an officer of the court. And so a lawsuit being filed, naming a prominent individual in regard to a crime, we're going to publish a story about that.
Nevertheless, errors can sometimes be made, as
true.
We saw in the New York Times this week, and so it looks like the press is trying to deliberately do harm.
Makes it look that way. Yeah, that's true. You're talking about the Brett Kavanaugh story, in which the New York Times did, a selection from a new book called The Education of Brett Kavanaugh, written by two New York Times reporters. And in this, the Times handled it poorly, I think many people would agree. And the result was that the Times, in effect, gave fuel to the president's claim that the media is just out to get him. Is that your concern, Rosemary?
That's definitely my concern. And
Rosemary, why don't you bring everybody who may have missed some of this up to date on how all this went down?
Well, these two reporters wrote a very extensive book, an investigation of what Brett Kavanaugh did or did not do at Yale. They did what the FBI should have but did not do. And in addition to the allegations we already know about, they found another woman who was subjected to his hideous harassment, supposedly, at a party. He exposed himself to her. However, in the book, they make clear the woman does not remember it herself. Possibly alcohol was involved. Others at the party do remember. She would not testify. In excerpting the book in the Times, they left out that very salient and exculpatory information that she did not remember and didn't want to talk. They corrected it later, but by then the damage was done. And so you have the right-wing media saying, see, they're just out to get Kavanaugh and, by extension, Trump, no matter what. I think the Times has done a horrible job explaining how this happened. I think that James Bennett, the opinion page editor, should face some discipline. I'd fire him myself. This is about the third time he's made a major mistake. Not directly, but you understand his department is responsible for it.
Hey, Rex, you agree that he should be fired?
Well, I don't know that I would make that judgment. I don't know enough of the details of what kind of decision-making went into it, but there certainly have been some stumbles. The problem is that we are in a situation where any little judgment error is so elevated because the Trump administration is attacking the press daily unfairly. You know, the Times churns out incredibly strong journalism every day, truth-telling, that gets denigrated by the president as being untrue, this from a man who lies daily many times in public. And so any time that there's a stumble like this, it makes you feel as though, gosh, maybe he's got something right there.
Well, sorry, Judy, I'm going to jump in here.
Go ahead.
I think that is just like so weak on the New York Times. They are the major target of this fake news stuff. And this is not a stumble. That's like calling it an incident. It's a major mess up. And I'm sorry that they've lost dozens of editors in the past few years. And that certainly must play something into it. But there have been a series of mistakes, and they've all been sort of like this, an anti-Semitic cartoon ran in the opinion section. Sarah Palin has a lawsuit going because they connected an ad her PAC put out with the shooting that it resulted in Gabby Giffords. These are not stumbles, Rex. These are huge errors. And the person responsible, as someone who got fired from a newspaper for a whole lot less, feels that he should be held accountable for.
Right. We all make mistakes, and we talk about how we work to fix this mistake. But this is a story about a Supreme Court justice. This is a major mistake.
Right.
And it was more than one stumble. And one of my thoughts when I first saw that horrible, horrible, horrible tweet that the opinion section put out on Saturday night saying it may seem like harmless fun to have a penis thrust in your face. Well, ooh. No. Never. Bad tweet, and bad that even anybody thought that. But then the point was, well, why is this buried in the opinion section? And why didn't the reporters, while they were reporting the book, report this to the news desk and say, hey, I've got a piece of news here. We shouldn't bury and wait until the book comes out. Maybe we should put this out before the public here and now. How does that work when reporters are working on books?
So why does an editor do a tweet like that? You know,
that was the lack of oversight.
It's not clear who wrote the tweet. In fact, one of the reporters themselves may have done it. She's not being very transparent about it. And yes, the reporters should have alerted her, but the editors read the story. How come the editors didn't talk to the editors and news saying, hey, we got this big thing, take a look at it?
Okay, so as usual, I'm a little confused. Why was this a news story as opposed to an editorial story? Could somebody back me up on that?
Well, what Rosemary is saying is that there is news that was being made
here.
The news was that there was another incident allegedly involving Kavanaugh.
Right.
And so when that was revealed, there should have been a news story about that initially.
I get it.
This is not the first time that reporters working for a newspaper have not reported something because it was in a book. I mean, this is, of course, what Bob Woodward does all the time at the Washington Post. He is constantly gathering information. Even though he's an associate editor of the Post, he still gathers information for his books and makes headlines when his book is published rather than putting it in the story in the news section of the paper.
But his stories, when they are ready to be published, always appear first in the Post, as did these two reporters. Their story, when they were ready to break it, did appear first in the New York Times. There was just a huge fumble in how it was handled.
And it's opened up the whole industry, once again, to Trump's anti-media rhetoric. It hurts us all. And they have a lot more people than most papers do, than any other newspaper does, probably. They have the resources. There should be no excuses.
Yeah.
Well, now I feel for both Rex and Judy when she was in this job. This has got to be very heavy responsibility on your parts to make sure you get it right. And that if anybody who is serving under you gets it wrong, then you're going to be held responsible. I think that's a very heavy thing for an editor to go through.
We make mistakes sometimes, and you try to correct them, but you can't always. And sometimes what people think of as mistakes are, you know, a result of their misunderstanding of what's going on. People don't have access to all the information that we have. And here's what's more difficult than just a simple mistake, and that is when you have a what seems to be a mistake in the tone of your story or the direction that it's going. If you perhaps misunderstand the reality of a situation, that's very hard to fix when a story kind of takes the wrong tack.
And yet, Rosemary says, an editor who screws up should be fired.
Especially in this atmosphere, I think that we've lost the luxury of saying, well, we're taking care of this in-house. What happens at the New York Times, particularly in a story at this scale, is of interest to the whole country. And they need to be able to say, we handled it badly. Here's what we've done to make sure it never happens again. And I think Bennett needs to go.
Bennett or Jim Dow, the deputy?
He's the deputy, and he spoke up. I think Jim Bennett's the one who's been avoiding comments, and he's the guy in charge. The buck stops at his desk.
Or maybe they should consider a reorganization and have the Sunday Review section be put under the news operation. I mean, that's a really big operation, and I know that it's long established that, you know, the opinion section handles that, but maybe it's time to bring it back under news.
Hmm. Well, but a mistake could have happened there, too. In other words...
News makes less mistakes or fewer mistakes. Fewer mistakes.
I don't know about that. I don't know that the opinion... It's just that if you have more license in opinion, of course, right, to say things. You're not allowed to, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan, I think, is credited with saying this, you're allowed your own opinions, not your own facts.
I think one of the things that bothers me about this whole story, I've been following it really closely this week, is that I think the Times is acting like the White House does. Bennett was not available for comment. Nobody spoke. Dow didn't speak until 2 days after it came out. It was all over. Where were they? This is an emergency. Get in there and talk to the media. No one knows how important it is to talk to the media, so much as the New York Times.
And what about the publishers? I mean, in other words, we are now saying to bishops, you look the other way when you knew something was going on or you didn't apologize or the rest of it. What about the publisher who's the head person?
Well, and there's renewed calls for a public editor at the New York Times. I mean, they have lost their public editor for a few years. And they said, well, the editors themselves, we will respond to these situations that they developed. And they didn't.
May I just point out, though, let's just be clear. It is what was left out of this was that the woman involved did not remember it and did not speak to the interviewers, right?
Correct.
That the key part that was
that's
left
the
out?
Part that was
okay.
left out.
That's the salient part that's left out. But there was a lot of information in this that was, some would say, quite relevant. Many people believed the allegation to be true and believed the previous allegations against Brett Kavanaugh and that he actually had perjured himself before the Senate in denying them and believed that we have a serial sexual predator on the Supreme Court. So this is not a black and white matter where the New York Times has attacked somebody with a spotless resume about whom there have not been previous allegations. As almost every crucial ethical decision is, it's a gray area. It is nuanced, and that's what makes it so difficult.
All lost because all we're talking about now is their stumbles.
And let's not forget that a lot of this information was given to the FBI, and it substantiated the fact the FBI did a very cursory investigation into allegations against Brett Kavanaugh. And that was also, I thought, A1 newsworthy.
Which is relevant and which is now obscured by all the talk about the stumble. This is why I'm sorry that this has happened, because now we're talking about how bad the New York Times is when I think the more relevant issue is the FBI in response to political pressure failing to thoroughly vet candidates for the Supreme Court.
Okay, look, first of all, the New York Times is a great institution. There's no question about it, and we all depend on it, and it has been doing magnificent work when it comes to the present set of circumstances. Nevertheless, you just can't say, okay, everything goes. If they make a mistake, they should probably say, we made a mistake. That's all.
Didn't they?
Yeah, I think they did.
They did that. The question is how far they should go beyond that. So,
I mean, even when Margaret Sullivan, who was the previous public editor that you mentioned, Judy, at the paper, called them, she now is working at the Washington Post, they stonewalled her. I'm sorry. Yes, they admitted it, but it was on their terms. It was with their spin. It was like what the White House does every day.
Anyway, we appreciate your thoughts. media@wamc.org if you have some thoughts about this. Alan Shartok, Rosemary Armeo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith here with you for the Media Project. Some more stuff from our readers, because that our listeners, I keep doing that, you know, the little habits die hard, because that last note did inspire quite a lot of conversation. Carl writes to say that he enjoyed our comments on revealing the names of mass shooters. You know, we had a conversation saying, should we be naming mass shooters? He says, my concern is that news sources should cover the firearms as much as the shooters. In the recent mass shootings in Texas, the gunman was just called a shooter. It took days before it was revealed that he had used a pistol or an AR. I want to know the type of guns used, where they were obtained, how they were bought, who they were registered to. This is just as much an issue as the identity of the gunman. So I think people do make note of that, but the police don't always release that information as soon as we would like for it to. We have deadlines, and we have to get the stories out.
Right? Well, what do you think, Rex? You think that's true? That, you know, they rise to the same level of interest on the part of the reporters or the paper?
I haven't thought about whether they rise to the same level of interest. I mean, I think we report the kind of weapon used all the time. Was it an automatic weapon? Was it a pistol? As soon as we know, that's a part of the story.
It's a classic question from a copy editor yelling across the room. What was this weapon? What did they use? What kind of gun? What kind of rifle?
Now, the classic copy editor's question, what kind of dog? You know, if somebody's saying he's walking his dog, what kind of dog? He was, okay, he's walking his Weimaraner. Whatever.
The bigger question may be the way the press covers mass shootings. You know, it isn't enough to just get who, what, where, when now. We do the same thing over and over again, that our coverage, like the mass shootings themselves, have taken on a sameness. So this is an attempt to say, okay, let's really look at the guns. I think that has been done, actually, multiple times to no consequence so far. We struggle to find a different way.
David in Poughkeepsie writes about the show where we talked about the difficulty of maintaining local journalism in the free market. And he has an answer, he says, that seems obvious to him but is rarely mentioned in these conversations. Alan, as you know from political science, David writes, a collective action is a specific type of problem where many people may want to see a public good provided, but know that their individual actions won't make the difference between it succeeding or not. Government is one of the best tools we as a society have for solving these problems. So David says public journalism grants could make sure that our democracy gets the journalism it needs. There are many different ways this could be organized to prevent political influence. For example, a Colorado city is creating an independent special improvement district that would fund local journalism via their library system. This may be the only way, David writes, to ensure that we have a competitive market for news, but many journalists are reluctant to see it as a possible solution, and if they won't take the first steps in advocating for news as a public good, who will?
Well, it's a very strong letter, obviously, and it's very provocative and a good idea, except that you've made the point 100 times, Rex, if once, that newspapers are owned by private companies. You know, there may be a few tiny exceptions, but would the fact that the government is now giving money to publishers and to other people be prohibitive in terms of the way we do business in this country?
Right. I think we even have a hard time when local economic development agencies want to underwrite the cost of building a new newspaper plant, as if that's ever going to happen again. But because we cover local economic development agencies, so you don't want to be beholden to them. We really want to be independent, and it seems like it might be a good idea, but we know that it's not going to work.
I think it's a great idea, and it won't work for newspapers, but it will work for new forms of journalism that are not only growing but becoming even more relevant than newspapers, things like ProPublica.
But the problem is those don't work in the local level. The news deserts in America are happening in places that are too small to be served by not-for-profits. It's a great notion.
That also is changing, Rex. I think
it is not. I have just come from a lecture from Penny Abernathy, University of North Carolina, where they're doing significant research on this. The problem with not-for-profit journalism is that it only arises in places where there's enough money to support it. The places where we are losing journalism, in the small communities, there isn't enough not-for-profit interest. You can't replicate the size of a newsroom that a newspaper used to have. You might get one reporter to cover rural Kansas or two reporters, but you're not going to get enough to support what's going on in Salina, Kansas, or in a local community.
So I want to just point out, as I always have, that Eileen Mooney in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, charges $35. She sends you $35, and she covers every word that is said at a town meeting or a selectman's meeting.
Covering every word at a town meeting is not the same as significant oversight journalism, and one person cannot do what a newsroom used to do.
Actually, she does a great job of doing exactly that, Rex, but the point really is you got to start somewhere, and she has started, and it works in Great Barrington.
So that's a for-profit enterprise? Is that going to work?
I don't think she makes any money on it, I'll be honest with you. She may, but I doubt it.
Maybe Rosemary's right. Maybe there will be not-for-profit groups that will arise in small communities. That would be swell, wouldn't it?
Well, you've called for that many times. You've talked about how that's the look of the future, haven't you?
Yes. Rex is kind of intimidating because you obviously feel stronger about it in your position than
I
do.
Well, I just heard some great research about this, and I'm just saying it's not happening.
Except that research looks in the past, and we're looking in the future. Newspapers are not coming back. It would be great.
Of course they're not.
If we had the New York Times all over the country as we used to and had regional and local newspapers, that would be great. But they are not coming back. And in that absence, in that vacuum, new forms will and are already developing. There are tiny places in St. Louis that I know of, in Youngstown, that are developing almost like hobbyists.
Yeah.
Gadflies are looking to replace it. I personally believe the government, as they do in the BBC in England, that's the way to go. But they are developing, and I think you are going to see more of them in the future. Will they be as good as Hearst? No, they will not. There's no question about that.
And there are many different models, right? There can be many models at the same time.
That's right. There could be many different models. Actually, what our letter writer, David from Poughkeepsie, suggests, government grants, is one of the key advocates of that is the president of Columbia University, who is a lawyer, First Amendment specialist, Lee Bollinger, wrote extensively about this just before Donald Trump became president and kind of rused the day, because this is not going to happen. There is not going to be federal support for journalism. But it's indirect. You know, foundations which are tax exempt are in effect therefore subsidized by taxpayers. And so foundations providing money to support newsrooms, that's a great idea, right?
Has any of us ever seen a government entity that gives money out one way or the other, or gives favors out, or grants access, that when the mud hits the fan, doesn't want to control how much resources a newspaper or another place gets? I mean, that's what the problem is here. It never fails.
Well, another model that's been discussed and hasn't developed yet is that Google and Facebook, the places that are cannibalizing real journalism, they're going to run out of things to cannibalize soon. And they can get involved in news.
Yep, absolutely. All right, we're unfortunately out of time.
But so, I have something to say very quickly.
Well,
Rex,
then you'll have to do it on next week's show.
No,
thank you very much.
I'll do it right now. I want to apologize if anyway I've antagonized you in all of this, but thank you very much for correcting me.
You're welcome. I'm always happy to try to set you straight, Alan. Rosemary Armeo, Judy Patrick,
right.
Alan Shartok, and Rex Smith, thank you for joining us on The Media Project.
Such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.